Got it.
Perfect. So thank you. It is 4:35 p.m. and this evening I have Professor Baldwin here. He's a leading urbanist, historic and cultural critic, and he largely examines the landscape of global cities through the lens of the African diasporic experience. And the questions I am going to ask during this interview are to get a better understanding of the perceived relationship between the Trinity College community and the broader Hartford community, specifically as it relates to Trinity's gates and the way the positionality of these gates affect our interactions. Mm-hmm. And so my first question is, can you tell me a bit about your background? Where did you grow up? And what was your journey to like becoming a professor and an author?
Sure. So I actually grew up in a college town in Wisconsin, Beloit, Wisconsin, but it's also a factory town. So it was interesting. It was a combination of both living in the shadows of my own ivory tower, that's the name of my book, and most all of my family never knowing anything about the college because they were working class Black folk that worked in factories or in people's homes as domestics. And so growing up my whole life, I knew that the small town life wasn't for me. I always wanted to be in a city. I went to undergraduate school at Marquette University, which is in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, right in the middle of the downtown area. Got there though and was totally frustrated because I realized that Milwaukee was nothing but a big, small town. And then I ended up going to graduate school in New York, New York City. I went to NYU for graduate school, which was the perfect, for me, the perfect kind of articulation of what I wanted. I lived in Brooklyn, took the train to Greenwich Village. And then my first job was at Boston College, which is actually in an affluent outer neighborhood of Boston. It's not in the city directly. It's in Chestnut Hill, which is like one of the immediate suburbs of Boston. And then from there, I came here. So I've always been interested and concerned and frustrated and in love with cities and city life, city experience. And so even before I knew it, the work that I had been doing was always urban related, even when it wasn't explicit. And it wasn't until I got here to Trinity that I began to like explicitly call myself an urbanist because of like over 15 years of urban research. Most of my work is, you know, has been primarily looking at communities, you know, urban marginalized urban communities, looking at their culture, their politics, their ideas, their social interactions, and that thread that of the undocumented, of the marginalized, of the unrecognized has been consistent in all the work that I've done up to this point.
Awesome. You kind of answered this a little bit, but the next question was just like, where do you draw like your inspiration for the books you authored?
So if you're talking about my last book, In the Shadow of the Ivory Tower, which is like, you know, directly applicable to this discussion.
Yes.
My inspiration was drawn from the communities that I talked to. And as I said, as I was kind of suggesting in the first answer, most kind of urban studies research is kind of technocratic, looking at statistical data sets, mapping, infrastructure, roads, tunnels, and other buildings. And I felt that there was so much missing in that approach. And so by drawing my attention to higher education institutions as themselves urban developers, I do look at maps and master plans and all the things that traditional urbanists look at. But for me, it was clear, number one, having grown up in a college town, but number two, being of color and having taught and attended predominantly white institutions, that it was communities of color that surround campuses that actually make campuses work. And so for me, what was really instructive was that what would it mean to evaluate higher education, not from just simply the perspective of its students and its leadership, but from the communities and individuals that actually sustain it. In some ways, they have a more intimate and profound knowledge about how higher education functions more than anybody else. And so I talked to both presidents and administrators and students, but also low-wage cafeteria workers and corner boys and grandmamas and landscapers and, you know, community activists. Mm-hmm. And it's all those people who live in the surrounding communities of campuses. And it's from their experiences over 100 interviews. They're the ones who inspire me. But this inspiration ramped up even more because I was finishing the book just before the uprisings hit in the summer of 2020. Mm. And so much of what I was doing was pre-pandemic, pre-George Floyd. But these were the conditions that would not be surprised. These are the conditions that would make George Floyd not surprising.
Yeah.
And so, but it was still kind of just conversational, kind of academic. But then with the uprisings over the entire summer, the work took on a much greater import. It was no longer just simply an academic study. It became a resource for social movements. And so out of that, I have very modest claims about reforming police. But after the summer, I can say nothing but we need to abolish campus police. They need to be abolished. And I wrote an article about that in the Chronicle of Higher Education. And, you know, I had modest claims about the redistribution of resources from campuses to communities. But now after the summer 2020, it had to be, we needed a racial reckoning and a restructuring of campus budgets in order to account for the ways in which they extract directly resources from the communities around us. So it was all there, but it all took on a greater import and explicit nature because of the ways in which social movements pushed my work forward in a more profound way. So I would say that.
So now getting more into this relationship that you talk about, I'm sorry, I want to go back because you mentioned something that I thought was really important. And I would like if you would elaborate on it more specifically. Sure. You said how basically it's like the surrounding, the people who live in the community who are like the chart wall workers or, you know, that really sustain and make campus and like understand higher education from like a different perspective. Can you like talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah. So I just for me, it's like, okay, what would it mean? It's one thing to talk about higher education from this perspective of the student who comes in for 4 years, maybe five, and then leaves, or the administrator who lives in West Hartford comes into work and leaves. But what does it mean to understand it from the Chartwell worker who is here probably 8 or 9 plus hours a day, serving these kids, giving them what they think they want? What does it mean to look at this from the perspective of the paintball kids? Why they're shooting paintballs and not bullets? Mm-hmm. What's going on there? What is the commentary here? The kids who purposely sneak through the holes in the fence just to walk on campus and then to walk off campus. The families who stroll their babies through the campus but know nothing about what goes on here. So even, it doesn't mean necessarily these are folks that have a direct knowledge of the inner workings of the institution. Many of them do, but some of them don't. Mm-hmm. But even in their alienated relationship to the school that sits right in the middle of the neighborhood, what does their experience, how does that offer a different perspective and a more profound understanding of this institution, distinct from what it says it does as compared to how it actually does in function? Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay.
So like, how would you describe this perceived relationship between like Trinity College community, including like faculty, staff, and students, and the surrounding neighborhood? I guess I can combine this question a little bit because I feel like you'll talk about it, but like, in what role does Trinity administration play in either working to help or exacerbate this image?
Yeah. So, I have to go back a little bit, but so for decades, talking about Trinity College saw itself as a literal city on the hill. And it is that. It's actually on a hill. It was the finishing school for what today we call the 1%. It was only for boys and whites only. Not even at one point, not even Jews. Mm. So it was an articulate, like it's as a part of the next NESCAC, what later was called the Little Ivies. It's a reflection of elite power in the United States going back to 1823. What happens though, is that it starts in the downtown area. And then in about the 1860s, it moves to what was then called Gallows Hill. Like this is literally where they used to hang prisoners in this area, if you didn't know that. And it was on the, it was outside the city. And like other elite schools, so Trinity in Frog Hollow, Harvard in Cambridge, UChicago in Hyde Park, all these schools were purposely saw themselves as being these pastoral retreats outside of what they considered to be the corruption, the corrupting influences, and the kind of mongrel, multi-ethnic. Now, at this time, I don't even mean black and brown. I mean white, like white ethnic cultures.
Like
Italians, Jews. Irish, Jews, Polish, Bohemians. So as a refuge from all of that, as a place where the gentry elite, the land-owning elite, would come, reflect, be refined. They didn't come here to gain for career development. Their parents and their families and their networks already own financial houses. They already own industrial plants. This was a place to simply reinforce their already existing networks, to receive a confirmation of their already existing power. But then when we get to 1920s and immigration flows over this area, like it did in many cities, like also it did in Chicago and New York and other places. Also Harlem, New York's Columbia and Harlem was a suburb. It wasn't always the hood, right? It was farmland. And so anyway, my point. In the 20s, all these cities experienced industrialization, and the immigrants that were in the central city or not in the country yet are now at the doorstep of these schools. And the different schools had different approaches. UChicago demolished neighborhoods to keep a buffer between themselves and the so-called immigrant hordes. Trinity in the 20s, for a short period of time, created an Americanization policy. And what that meant was they were worried about the proliferation of too many Jews coming to the campus, and they didn't want their school to be a commuter school. So working class Jews from the city of Hartford were coming into school and then going back home. So they instituted an Americanization policy whereby every student that came here would have to be residential. You'd have to be on campus. What does that do? Explicitly, it doesn't say no Jews or no ethnics, but implicitly, if you can't afford the tuition and the room and board, it becomes a deterrent from coming to school here.
Right.
But if you are Jewish and you can afford the room and board, they argue, well, at least we are separating you from your ethnic neighborhoods and we can Americanize you into our culture. These were explicit commentary, and you can find these documents in the archives of Trinity College.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, and it's in my book too. So it's in the chapter on Trinity if you want to find it for the sources. So this was the profound way in which, you know, it worked. Now, don't get me wrong, that policy only lasted for a short period of time, but the idea of reducing the commuter population, making the school primarily residential, those policies maintain themselves. Mm-hmm. And so throughout the 20th century, that became the ethos, that this would be a place where the elites of New England, maybe the Eastern Seaboard, would send their children to come and get finished.
Mm-hmm.
And as we move into the 70s and 80s, it became those kids who couldn't get into Yale or couldn't get into Amherst came here. And then differently, because this was in the middle of a city, other schools were progressive and liberal in ways because they were in these college towns. They were in Amherst or Williamstown. So they could be progressive intellectually. But because Trinity was in the middle of the so-called hood, they became a hotbed for conservative families. And it became a feeder school to Wall Street. That became his claim to fame, that we have the networks at Wall Street and we will get you into a financial house. So while other schools were liberal in theory because they were not having to deal actually with diversity and poverty, with Trinity being in the middle of diversity and poverty, Trinity became known explicitly as a conservative liberal arts college, or attracting a conservative student body. The claim to fame is, you know, one of our alums is Tucker Carlson, mm-hmm. of Fox News fame, right? Yes. But he's just the tip of the iceberg. Those networks. So SIU, Ivy, the Hall, right? The fact that because we're in the middle of an impoverished city, that social life on campus became Vernon Street. Mm-hmm. And it became the fraternities and sororities. And then people's ideas of safe city was not even Hartford. They leapfrogged to West Hartford. So Trinity's notion of urban became a reproduction of the students' suburban ideas, right? They wanted a place just like home, because we were in the middle of a city that was nothing like home. Where is Wesleyan? Middletown. If you're in Middletown, or if you're in mm-hmm. Amherst, you can pretend to be urban all you want because there are no actual threats to your identity. You can't pretend to be urban around here. You were in the middle of a city. So the response to that was to turn inward and to fortify, to not leave the campus, or to leapfrog to West Hartford, right? But that turning inward only lasted for so long, until the 90s, where Trinity pulled his head up and looked around, and there was violence and there was poverty and violence everywhere. Mm-hmm. This is after white flight. So whites had left the city and industry had followed or actually led. There was no tax base. There were few jobs. And so what was left was Black and brown people trying to create their own economies, and primarily turn to the drug trade to a certain degree, or other forms of illicit or informal money getting. And so this had a huge impact on the reputation of the school. Even if there wasn't actual violence, people coming from elite, affluent neighborhoods like Greenwich or Westchester County or other places, Roland Park in Baltimore, or other parts of downtown Rittenhouse Square in Philadelphia, mm-hmm. wherever you're from, the poverty looked like violence. Images of poverty look dangerous to many people, even if it wasn't. So people stopped, enrollment numbers went down in the 90s, and Trinity had to do something. There were, and I think it was 93, let me get this right just to be sure. Sorry.
No, you're totally fine.
94. This is where the most iconic image or symbol of violence popped off, when the Latin Kings and Los Toledos barreled across Summit and went down Vernon. This is when Vernon was a public street, and crashed into one of the campus buildings at the intersection of Vernon and Broad. And they jumped out and kept fighting until campus police cornered them into a building. And then Hartford PD followed and subdued the unrest. Now on one side, you'll say, oh my God, this is crazy. That's violence like crazy. But another perspective is like, well, wait a minute. When you don't invest in the city and you concentrate all your wealth in the middle of this campus, what do you think is gonna happen?
Right.
But anyway, that became justification. Trinity argued that they needed to, there was already a gate across Broad Street, but Vernon was a public through street.
Mm-hmm.
So they made the case, and you probably read this, they made the case that they used the language of safety, that there are local, and I'm putting this in quotes, like in scare quotes, local cars are coming up and through Vernon Street, and it's creating a traffic safety issue. Now, everyone knew that this was not about traffic safety, because most of the cars that were barreling up and down Vernon were Benzes and Cadillacs, i.e. the cars of students.
Right.
The issue was making a symbolic statement to potential families and existing students that this place was safe. And so Trinity was still so powerful, and it still is, that they were able to make a case to City Hall to run the gate that ran across Broad Street, across Vernon and Broad, and to essentially turn Vernon into a private Trinity Street. And that exists to this day.
Yes.
So some Very students might so. Wonder why there's that mini roundabout at the foot of, this is landscaping to erase the history that this was an actually through street at one point in time.
And honestly, I would have never known if I hadn't had this conversation.
I know I gave you a lot of history. I'm sorry.
It's okay. Right? I'm just looking through my questions because you answered a good amount of them. But which is a good thing, though. I'm so happy. I'm learning so much. So I guess what do you think needs to be done?
Yeah.
Or no, I'm sorry. I'm going to go back because I kind of want to.
The fence. Let's talk about the fence a little bit more.
Yeah, about the fence. Like, how does, I guess, the Hartford community see it? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Because for most students, like, we don't even really know that it was ever open. It doesn't really mean anything.
Right.
Other than, I don't know, privacy or closure.
Yep. Sure. Yep. So one thing must be made certain is that almost everybody in Hartford is so proud to have Trinity in its city. They're all very proud. But at the same time, they just wish Trinity would act better.
Yeah.
Right? That they wouldn't come into the city from the perspective of trying to help. That we have knowledge and we want to transfer it to you as a way to help you, or that we don't have knowledge and that you can't learn from us, or that, you know, you create your action lab and you look, and the way you come to understand us is as a social problem that needs to be fixed as compared to being collaborative. And that's all changed. A lot of this is changing with the new leadership at the Liberal Arts Action Lab and SHARE under Professor Williamson and others, Eric Crowley and, you know, people, you know, like that, you know, they're doing amazing work. Carlos Espinosa, and, you know, a lot of people are doing really, really important work, and the work that's going on with HMTCA. So things are changing, but for so long, the perspective is like, you know, what, see us as partners and co-creators as compared to a parent child or a steward caseworker client approach, if you will. Right. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. And so then from that, then the fence is just a constant reminder of how pronouncements don't necessarily line up with actual practices. Okay. Mm-hmm. So the fence, the irony though, is that there are literal holes all throughout this argument about the fence as a form of security and safety, because there are holes all throughout the fence that both students and residents run through every day. So it's very clear in practice that the fence is not about even actual safety. It's about the symbolic nature of safety. And the demarcation between what happens here as separate and distinct from what happens on the other side of the fence, where in fact, a lot of the same behaviors and practices that we associate with the locals are actually generated from students. And residents know this, right? So when there is a theft of a bicycle, or some, you know, computer equipment on campus. And the perspective is, oh, we need to protect our borders. Residence hood logic says, well, it's probably from a drug deal gone bad and that the student didn't pay. And so this was reparations or payment in lieu of direct payment. Like, this is not all just simply danger and innocence. There are already intimate relationships between the city and resident and campus in ways that don't get documented publicly, right? So then the fence becomes a manifestation. It becomes the most visible expression of enclosure, of turning inward, even though actual interactions are not as enclosed as we might hope to think. So for example, a couple other cases. So the Crescent Street townhouses, that used to be a mixture of student dorms, faculty offices, and local residential apartments. Then it got turned into suburban style, homogeneous, luxury student dorms, student townhouses that require extra pay. They cost extra. And all the backs of the townhouses face the community. The Koppel Community Sports Center. In order to get the $3 million to finish that site, Trinity put the term community in the name. But the centerpiece of it is an ice rink. How many West Indians and Puerto Ricans do you know that would consider an ice rink a community benefit? Doesn't mean that they don't want to learn how to skate, but when you look at when are the community hours? The community hours are during school hours and on the weekends when ice rink is filled up with adult leagues from the suburbs. So the infrastructure, so again, pronouncements versus practices. So from the outside, it's clear that that was an amenity to raise the profile for recruiting top recruits for the hockey team,
mm-hmm.
the ice rink. But the community name in it helped generate the income, the wealth, the finances to finish it. So when you look at the fence and the Koppel's Community Sports Center and the townhouses, these become ways in which you can claim an open campus,
mm-hmm.
but the perimeter, the points of contact between the campus and the community tell a different story at the level of practice.
Totally understand. And actually, I've taken a couple spring classes at the Koppel Community Center. And when I, now thinking about it, I always assumed community meant like Trinity College community. Like I just always assumed
that.
Wow.
That's the way it functions.
Yeah, and that's the way it seems to me. I just think of it as like a student, like athletic center off campus, because the hockey rink is there.
Mm-hmm.
And my last question, kind of is three part, but
okay.
Just about what do you think would need to be done on both ends
to work towards
creating a better relationship, and how can this best be facilitated, and is it even possible, not even just on Trinity's campus, but a lot of campuses where there's like this dichotomy between like the campus and the surrounding community.
Yeah. So first of all, it's funny. I was lecturing at the University of Winnipeg in Canada a few years ago, giving basically the same story I'm telling you, but in a national context. And an administrator, a guy with a suit on, was smirking and whispering. And I thought, oh, he doesn't like what I'm saying. You know, is this typical? But he came up to me afterwards and was like, you know, have you seen our campus? Do you know what we do here? And so he walked me around and showed me, but he was frustrated, but not for the reasons I thought. He was frustrated because, like, you know, all the things you're calling for, we do here.
Mm-hmm.
There is an alternative way of doing these things. And they did it not because out of the goodness of their heart. They did it because their population on campus exploded from 6,000 students to 10,000 students in a matter of a couple of years in the 2000s. But most of the students were low-income indigenous adults that lived in the surrounding neighborhoods. And they understood that in order to meet the needs of this different kind of demographic, the non-white, non-commuter, non-middle-class residents, they would have to create different supports and different kinds of amenities to meet their needs. So not rock climbing walls, not luxury townhouses, not gourmet cafeterias, but affordable housing with two and three bedrooms for families, childcare facilities for working class families that would come onto campus, job opportunities for family other members of the family who aren't even going to school to support the family member that is going to school. And so this is what happened. They developed the university created their own development corporation and built out housing that was both for residents in the city and campus students that was at premium rates, market rates, affordable rates, and rent geared to income. So at all levels, the premium rates, the only difference is that they have balconies. All the other housing units were interchangeable. So you would, if you moved in, you wouldn't know if you were in a market rate or an affordable rate. So these are interchangeable. So they did that. And they also because student government is the organization, because student activity fees, they underwrote a campus child care center. So they asked them to raise student activity fees in order to increase the slots in the child care center for this new population. An important thing they did that's very different than the Coppell Community Center is that, because if you don't know, Winnipeg is like brick cold like 9 months out of the year, like below zero cold. So there's a high premium on indoor spaces. So what they did was they built a new recreational facility like the Coppell Community Center, but they placed it under a community charter. What this means is that there were guaranteed hours reserved for community organizations at peak times of the day. Mm-hmm. So not at 5 a.m. and not at midnight, but in the middle of the day, there are set hours weekly reserved for community organizations, for soccer pickup games, for powwows, for things that the primarily indigenous communities and the immigrant communities that surround the campus would want to partake in. Very different model. Very different approach. So people say, well, is there another way of doing it? Yes, there's another way of doing it. So to apply that here, when I spoke to the Board of Trustees a couple weeks ago about what are some solutions, number one, you got to reopen Vernon Street. You got to take down that. I'm not saying even take down the whole fence, but at least reopen Vernon Street. The first response is that, well, what about security? Won't that be dangerous? And I tell them that is the biggest deterrent to security. This is why kids run around Broad Street, Summit Street, paintballing Trinity students, because they resent the separation and the isolation. If you actually embed yourself in the community, if there were some knuckleheads to come on campus and cause some damage, it would be community members would be the first ones to tell them, yo, Trinity does right by us. Knock it off. Mm-hmm. Community engagement is the best mechanism of security as compared to turning inward. Another solution would be, what would it mean if Trinity built workforce housing? Now, by workforce, I mean the primarily low-wage Black and brown women and men that work for Chartwells, that work on the grounds crews, that work, in campus security. Mm-hmm. Number one, that would be an environmental statement, because they wouldn't have to commute. They would live where they work. They would be longstanding residents that would help anchor and ground this campus within the community surrounds it. And it would also create a mixed environment whereby students would literally have or directly have a more urban campus experience because of the integration of residents with students. We talk all the time about the catchphrase being liberal arts college in the capital city. But most of our students only engage with the city from the perspective of what it can do for them as an internship, as a lab, as a restaurant. But what would it mean if a part of your actual urban experience as a student was literally living with residents and interacting with residents during off hours? Not just simply security guards breaking up your parties or serving you midnight buffet after tropical, but actually having daily substantive interactions that don't pitch you as being as the servants, as being as servers and servants. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, servers and served. You get what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Yeah. This would be a liberal arts college in the capital. This would be a real urban experience. Right? Urban experiences aren't controlled. They aren't heavily manicured. They're dynamic. They're unpredictable. They're not homogeneous. They're not full of cul-de-sacs and you know, housing-only blocks with no retail. Negotiating, you know, urban communities are about negotiating sound levels. They're about negotiating, right, you know, what happens on the street corner. They're negotiating how you move down the street. That's an urban experience. We don't have that here.
I think, like, this relationship or bettering it, like, would be possible long-term, just because I never really thought about this, and hearing about the history of Trinity and everything, it's like, the parents who send their kids here, they're not trying to make them have this urban experience at all. They're actually, right, like you said, trying to make them have a home away from home. And so until that mindset is changed and you have students coming here because they actually want to engage with the community and are actually committed to these ideals, I think, and the parents as well who send their kids, I think that's a big thing as well. Like, you do and you follow where the money is coming from. And if the money, where it's coming from is saying, you know, we want these gates and we want these traditions, right, and the blah, blah, blah to continue, then you're kind of like shut.
But I'm glad you mentioned the money, because we continue, not just Trinity, but other elite schools, we continue to chase the ideal student in their mind, which is the white suburban family or affluent family that can pay $70,000 a year. Mm-hmm. But demographically, those families aren't having children anymore at the same rates. So schools are panicking about the loss of that base. The current response is austerity. We'll just shut down. We'll let people go. We'll fire people. But there is another option. The other option is, there's a whole community of people that want to go to school that don't fit the demographic. The Pell eligible working poor, working class students. So like in Winnipeg, if we turned our attention to the Pell eligible community and began to target them as our potential students, that's going to be the future of higher education. But if we do that, it's going, like in Winnipeg, it's going to require a different set of support services, like work study jobs, like jobs for the family members of those students, like housing. These are the things that are going to have to be created in order to support that demographic that will transform what it means to imagine the typical college student. And if we get out in front of that, it's the urban colleges that are more suited to do that work than the, say, stores or Amherst or, you know, Schenectady or Albany, where college towns are. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
We're actually better equipped to do that kind of work, but it's a matter of will. And we have a history of moments. It's like when former President Evan Dobell, who came here in the 90s after the fence was built, you know, there was a moment where this community was increasingly Puerto Rican and Dominican. And they had a massive concert headlined by Tito Puente. And they invite, who was and still is, even though it's passing, a salsa superstar. And they invited the entire community to come be on campus and for this concert. And a lot of students hid in their dorms. But even in that, right now, urban engagement means us going out and delivering our services to the city. And then a couple of bright, lucky HMTCA students get plucked up and brought to campus to take classes. What would it mean if we literally welcomed the campus, the city onto the campus? It would mean integration and access to resources for the students, for the residents. And it would mean a real robust understanding of the understanding of liberal arts college in the capital city for the students. And we're living in the urban century now. More people in the world live in an urban environment for the first time than they live in an agricultural rural environment. So the city is our, urban environments are our future. So if we see this site as a training ground, not just for career development, but for an orientation towards our future lives, for developing what I call an urban citizenship, what it means to be in the world, that could be game-changing, transformative.
Definitely.
But we're not ready. We're not there yet. We're not there yet. We're not ready for it.
Not at all. I think, like you said, we'll get there.
Yeah.
It's just.
Yeah. But, to the credit of the president and a couple other people, bringing in and last, because of this is credit to the student activism that happened last year too. Because of student activism, now we're hiring faculty of color that are coming with an orientation towards the community. They're building out programming with the Social Justice Institute, with My Smart Cities Lab. They're doing things that are with the Center for Hartford Engagement and Research. They're doing things that are making it more difficult for students to ignore engagement. Right. Right, it's still very selective who participates in all that, but it's harder to ignore this as a part of the Trinity experience. Right. And I think as that continues, and if the demographic, if we get more posse students, if we start targeting Pell eligible students, the long walk will look different. Right, it won't just be the hip hop blaring out of the dorms. It'll be the kids who create the hip hop on the long walk, and the salsa and the reggaeton. And what have you, they'll be in the classroom and not just hearing their music out the dorm room. That will begin to change this dynamic.
I really think so too. And I'm hopeful for that in the future. And I thank you so much for your time. I've learned so much and have debunked so many things in my head.
What's one thing that you debunked in your head? What's the one that jumps out at you that you debunked in your head? If you can tell me.
I'm gonna stop the recording.
Sorry. Yep.
No, it's okay. So we're done.
Yeah. Drug trade. Yeah, there's a thriving drug trade on this campus, and it's primarily white on white. And the reason why it's able to thrive is because of the presumption that crime is elsewhere, right? And so then we talk about being open campus, but when we look at the disparate policing of crime on campus, there is an immediate notice when there's a paintball incident. There's an immediate notice when a boy on a bike grabs a girl's butt, and by girl, we almost know they mean white girl. But there is little conversation about the lucrative drug trade on this campus. When there is debauchery, there was just a massive fight that happened on Vernon Street between a football player and some kids that were bullying him. He knocked out like 5 kids. No public announcement. But when there is a culture house party and non-students are invited, there is a requirement for an additional layer of security. Students of color have to wear Trinity paraphernalia to demonstrate that they are not a local, which suggests that if they were a local, disparate treatment would be justifiable. All these things challenge at the interpersonal level the idea that this is an open campus. The disparate treatment of similar activity. The argument, my own student years ago talked about the open, basically the Amsterdam, the open drug trade on this campus, and she called it criminal amnesty. But instead of investigating this, what did Trinity administration do? They took that term amnesty and turned it into a policy to say that in the name of keeping students safe, we are going to offer them what?
Amnesty.
So that they can self-report and not be sick or not be injured from a drug overdose. They took her critique and turned it into a policy. These are the decisions that the administration makes instead of offering a more robust and engaged and integrated campus experience. They continue because the idea is that we need to protect the brand. This is why the extra security, the subcontracted security, not campus police, but the subcontracted security team, they patrol the perimeter. Because the message is that we are protecting your children from the danger that is Hartford. While there are multiple dangers, sexual, substance, physical abuse, on this campus, student on student. So these behaviors and interactions are predicated on identifying dangerous elsewhere. And this is how we interact with Hartford in multiple ways. That has to be addressed. It has to be attacked. It has to be announced and then addressed. But these are the ways in which we can claim open campus while live a very closed life. So I'll stop. I just want to put that out there. I just want to stop that. I'll say that. I'll end with that.